The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning glory America, bonjour high Canada, Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway on 5/5/2022, the year of our Lord 2022. I'm learned this morning that there's a character in the scriptures named Ahio. That's because I begin the days when I wake up very early by listening to the Bible in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz, which is probably the most listened to podcast in America by people who are trying to get through the entire scripture in 1 year. And he's really good. And I recommend I tweet it out. So there in the list of names, it's either in 2 Samuel or Chronicles. I think it's 2 Chronicles. Azan and his brother Ahio are wandering along. And Azan makes a mistake of touching the Ark of the Covenant and dies. Not reported what Ahio did at that point. So I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if Ahio is the reason that Ohio is Ohio. Because maybe Ahio said, oh, then I thought, no, that can't be. So I looked it up, and sure enough, it's not. That's a false trail. That's a rabbit hole. Ohio is an Iroquois name from the Great River, Ohio. And I should have known that. I probably knew that in 7th grade Ohio history in Warren, Ohio at Blessed Sacrament, but I didn't remember it. So that's how I begin your day with this fun fact to know and tell. Ohio is named for the Iroquois name for the Great River, Ohio. Let me get to the news. Good news in Ukraine as Ukrainian forces retake villages near the city of Kharkiv, relieving pressure on the city. Russia is just, they lost another general. We're helping them kill the generals. They're up to 12 dead Russian generals, maybe 13 by now. And they're pushing back, and Russia is contemplating a call. Not going to be happy about going to the death trap and the death trap tanks, but Russia is falling back in many places. Doesn't mean the war isn't over. They're still a much bigger country. They still have many more arms. They still have much more money. But we will see. We will see when and if Putin decides enough is enough. I'm not getting my objectives here. There will be elections today in Northern Ireland, in Ulster. Sinn Féin is set, and that's the Irish Republican Army political arm for many years during the Troubles. Sinn Féin is now a political party that has many seats in the Irish Parliament. They're set to gain a majority in the Ulster Parliament today for the first time ever. Many people see that as a path to a, quote, united Ireland. Ireland is not physically divided, but it has been politically divided since the creation of the Republic of Ireland, I think in 1922. And Aaron will correct me if I'm wrong on that. And inevitably, it's going to happen because of demographics and because of the march of history. And because Ulster is becoming more Catholic Irish than Protestant Irish. And hopefully it will happen peacefully and devolution will occur. And Ireland go the way of the EU and the United Kingdom will be Scotland, Wales, and England, since that's all one island. But Ireland is its own island. So we'll watch that today. That will be interesting. As I said, the New York Times reported U.S. intelligence helping Ukraine kill Russian generals. The rest of the rundown. Pope Francis blamed NATO and the Wall Street Journal. Well, they take the visor off of the Pope. He's just too old to do this job. And there are lots of people who are too old to do a lot of jobs. Speaking of which, let's go to Joe Biden, cut number 5 in the White House Roosevelt yesterday.
What happens if you have a state changes the law saying that children who are LGBTQ can't be in classrooms with other children? Is that legit under the way that the decision is written? What are the next things that are going to be attacked? Because this MAGA crowd is really the most extreme political organization that's existed in American history, in recent American history.
All right, let's just unpack that. First of all, put aside the Ku Klux Klan, put aside the Nazi sympathizers, put aside the John Birch Society, put aside Antifa, put aside the January 6th protester, the MAGA crowd. In reference to the Supreme Court decision by 5 justices, 3 of whom were nominated by President Trump, all of whom were distinguished jurors long before President Trump came down the escalator as candidate Trump, And of course, the Chief Justice and Clarence Thomas have been on the court for a very long time. And Justice Alito is a George Bush appointee as well. W. Bush appointee. And I'm just here to tell H.W. Bush. What did I say? Well, the George W. Bush appointee. And I'm just here to think he came up after Harriet Myers was withdrawn. So it's Chief Justice Roberts, then Justice Alito. I'm just here to tell you, the uniter in chief, that's just not true. This is such an over-the-top comment that, again, it's like the Pope saying NATO is responsible for invading Russia. MAGA is the most extreme. And by the way, LGBTQ children, I understand some children so identify. I also understand that no teacher in America would ever separate them. And I also understand that that would fail rational basis review. It is the reddest of herrings I have ever heard. It's the stupidest thing I've actually ever heard Joe Biden say. It's a non sequitur on top of a non sequitur. Can we hear it again? Because getting a non sequitur squared is really something. Cut number five.
What happens if you have a state change the law saying that children who are LGBTQ can't be in classrooms with other children? Is that legit under the way the decision is written? What are the next things that are going to be attacked? Because this MAGA crowd is really the most extreme political organization that's existed in American history.
Seriously, he could have said, what if Zeppelins cross over from Canada and drop frozen turkeys on Cincinnati because they saw it on a TV show? Because that's where the decision takes us. That's about how much sense it makes as a matter of law. And he used to put on, when he attacked Alito, he said, I didn't go to any fancy law school. I love Princeton. I hate Princeton. He's been this way for decades. You elected him, America. He's our guy. He's our president. I say a prayer for him every morning. But honest to goodness. Well, the Fed yesterday raised an interest rate 0.5 point. But as I'll tell you in the next segment, markets just took off because it wasn't 3/4 and he appeared to take that off the table. American consumers, according to the Wall Street Journal, are shopping, traveling, and working out like it's 2019. Hooray! This is, I went to the movies last night after having dinner with son number two. We saw The Northman. Oh, do I have to talk to Sonny Bunch about that? I don't know how movies like that get made. That's about the dumbest movie I've seen in a long time since I saw the last dumb movie I saw. Anyway, I'm glad. Now many Americans are resuming their pre-pandemic habits, rocking out at crowded concerts, doing deadlifts next to strangers at the gym, and stocking a standard supply of toilet paper. Airline restaurants and child care centers, which relied on government loans to stay afloat during COVID-19 peak, can now hardly keep up with demand. Excellent, excellent, excellent. Excellent, excellent, excellent. This is great. However, all that money is going to be more inflation. We do not need more COVID relief, President Biden. We don't. We need people to go back to work. We need the interest rates to go up, and we need the economy to grow on its own, not with more stimulus. Abortion dominated the coverage. I commented last night before I went out to the movie that, if you read the elite media, and I do every night show prep, it's so deep blue. It's so pro-abortion rights. You won't get a sense of it. Republicans on cusp of abortion win seek to change the subject. No, they're not. I'm going to play for you in segment three, John Thune on the Senate floor. It's the best example. But Joni Ernst on this show yesterday, Nikki Haley, we are all proudly pro-life. We want to restrict abortion, but do so via state legislatures and not change a single blue state law. That's the bottom line. We're not trying to change the subject. We're happy to campaign on that subject. And if blue states don't want candidates adopting that subject, you will get Republicans like Pete Wilson running in states like that, who have always been pro-choice. It reflects the federalism of America. This is abortion pills by mail pose challenge for officials in red states. No, they don't. They can't stop those. The Interstate Commerce Clause. Once close allies, Roberts and Alito have taken divergent paths. No, they have not. They are still together far more than they are apart. And there's no indication that Chief Justice did not assign the opinion to Alito. That's a made up, a blue bubble media thing. Do Americans support abortion rights? Depends on the state. You betcha it does. You have to look at places like Ohio, which is deep red. White House scrambles for way to protect abortion. Of course they do, because they got fanatics. The party of fanatics is not MAGA. It's this left-wing crazy group. Meanwhile, a new subvariant of COVID is spreading. And it had a super spreader event at the White House Correspondents' Dinner on Saturday night. I was standing in line to get back to the United States. I wasn't invited to the White House Correspondents Association dinner this year. The Washington Post doesn't invite. It's contributing columnists I get. But I wouldn't have gone because they ravaged and savaged Sarah Huckabee the one time I went. And now many people have got COVID, including Secretary of State Tony Blinken. You know, I could have told you that was going to happen. It happened in Gridiron. Lots of people get COVID. I pray for Senator Blinken and everybody else. It's no fun. It's not going to kill you if you're double vaccinated, double boosted, but it ain't going to be fun. And so beware and do get your booster, please. I'll be right back, America. Don't go anywhere. I'm Hugh Hewitt, inside the Beltway on 5522. Welcome back, America. That's the same song from the North, but I'm playing it as Michael Oren joins me from Israel because King Bibi is coming back, I think. However, it is Independence Day in Israel and the 74th. Hi, Michael. How are you?
We're very good. We're all celebrating out here.
Well, that's what I figured.
The state of Israel.
74 years. You know, next year is going to be a blowout, isn't it?
I guess. Listen, when is it not a blowout?
You're right. But I want you to explain to new affiliates. I got a bunch of new affiliates. What the Day of Remembrance is. Everyone understands what Israel Independence Day is. The day that the state of Israel became a state. And the UN said so, and it will always be there, and it's reconstituted, and it's great. But the Day of Remembrance, I always find very moving, even though I'm not Jewish. Tell us about it.
It's really the only unique Israeli holiday. You know, Israel Independence Day is celebrated by Jewish communities around the world, but no one really marks Memorial Day the way we will mark Memorial Day. The entire country goes into mourning for 24 hours. A siren sounds at 8 o'clock at night, and then the next morning at 11 o'clock, the entire country stands still. If you're on the highway, cars go over the side. People stand at attention. We all visit military cemeteries. I was at a military cemetery yesterday. It's deeply moving because we have all lost friends and relatives in Israel's wars, victims of terror, and we pay homage. We go into this deep mourning, and the extraordinary thing is that at 8 o'clock at night, the next night, we go immediately into ecstatic celebration of Israel's independence. We go from this one, from radical mourning to radical, to ecstatic celebration. I don't know anything like it. I was in Washington.
There is nothing like it.
People ask me, how can we get America's Memorial Day to be like Israel's Memorial Day? And it's not easy.
Well, I do. I know some people celebrate our Memorial Day at Arlington. And when I went last week to the American Cemetery in Normandy with Dwayne, it was my second time there, extraordinary. But it is something that I always read the Times of Israel on the Day of Remembrance and say, wow, that's great. Now, back to what I led with, King Bibi. I see the articles. I see the smiling Bibi Netanyahu emerging from public, holding rallies. What say you, Michael Oren?
I say what I've said on this program many times, Hugh, that it's always premature to eulogize Bibi Netanyahu politically. Just when you think he's gone, he's dead. He comes back, and he is the ultimate comeback kid. And he stands to a very good chance of making the next government. He can put it together by prying members of the current coalition into the opposition. Or he can wait out this government until it tries to pass a budget next year and falls, and then go to the polls again. He is by far the most popular politician in the state of Israel.
Well, the reason I worry about hesitating and waiting is because the Iran deal is imminent. Iran is on the threshold of a nuclear weapon. Israel has to figure out what's necessary. And it seems to me that Netanyahu and Gantz and the party of the center right, which you are a member of, generally speaking, they all need to get together to figure it out. And the unserious people have to get out of the government.
Well, you could say about government everywhere, I guess. My big fear is if we do go to elections, we'll have the exact same outcome that we had repeatedly in 2019 through 2021, which is type of a deadlock where neither right, left, up or down can put together a coalition. Because the fact of the matter is the Israeli political pie has not been divided any differently than it was in the past. And as long as Netanyahu is in government, much of Israeli politics will be about him. Because the only reason that the center right can't put together a coalition is because there are a number of parties whose heads, put it mildly, do not like Netanyahu and will not sit in the same government with him. But if Netanyahu weren't there, his Likud party could join a coalition and be part of a very strong center-center-right government.
All right. Now, Dr. Orrin, Occam's razor. You're the former ambassador to the United States. You are the former ambassador to the UN. You are the former member of Knesset, former deputy minister. Occam's razor. Benny Gantz gets the first 6 months. Bibi Netanyahu gets the second 6 months. Everyone else keeps their portfolio, and the agreement is airtight. I mean, really airtight. But Benny has to start so that we have the two main players in Israel when it comes to national security in the cabinet at the same time. Is that just not possible? I mean, here's the non-Israeli non-Jew suggesting, here's what the Jews should do in Israel.
You know, why don't you live here, Hugh? I've been running around saying this for weeks. Just what you just said now, and what I get is a lot of head shakes here. But Occam raises, indeed, because Benny Gantz could sit in the government with Netanyahu, if not Netanyahu promised him the first shot at being prime minister in a rotation government. That's the only way Benny Gantz is going to be prime minister. And that would be a very strong coalition, and also strong, I think, in terms of strategic and defense affairs. I don't know why that scenario is not.
Do they just dislike each other that much? Do they dislike each other that degree?
Well, he maybe did betray Benny in the last rotation. But here's the difference. In that rotation, Bibi was the first prime minister, and
right.
Benny was the second prime minister. This time, Benny would be first, Bibi would be second, and Benny Gantz gets to be prime minister. It's the only way he's going to get to be prime minister. He's got nine seats. That's a good solid block.
And it's a majority maker. And I think of English politics in the 19th century. Yeah, I screwed you last week, but let's get together this week. Dr. Michael Orrin, have a great Independence Day in Israel. I can't wait till the 75th next year. I hope I taught you on that as well. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I was driving around on Sunday with some friends from Georgia, and they said, why haven't you had Latham Sadler on? He's running for Senate in Georgia, you know. And I told them, I don't know Latham Sadler. Why should I? And they explained to me, you know, he's a SEAL. He was in the Trump White House. He's a great candidate. And Susan Byers is your biggest fan. Latham, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great, Hugh. Pleasure to be on. I appreciate you having me.
I'm glad to have you. I want you to introduce yourself to our audience. I think if you were running in a primary that didn't have the most famous person in Georgia up against you, you would be the nominee. But tell people about your background.
Well, thank you, Hugh. I'm Latham. I'm a proud native son of Georgia, was born here in the state in Atlanta. My mother's from a small town in South Georgia called Bainbridge. Went to the University of Georgia about 20 years ago. 9/11 happened while I was a student there, changed my life forever. I didn't have plans to join the military till that day and decided I wanted to serve as a Navy SEAL officer. Had no idea what the heck I was getting myself into, and ended up spending the majority of my 20s trying to get there. So I went to Georgia Tech for a master's in international affairs, became fluent in Farsi and Dari, lived in the region for a full academic year, backpacked through Afghanistan, and then finally got picked up at the age of 28. Thank God made it through SEAL training and deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan. And then my final duty on active assignment was in the Trump White House as director for intelligence programs, managing the Black Ops portfolio. So I've been blessed as a national security guy to experience both ends of our national security spectrum. I mean, executing United States foreign policy on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then at the decision-making table at the White House on the National Security Council. And that's shaped the view and my view in which I see the world. And we're in trouble in this country right now, both from threats from within. We're heading on a very dangerous pathway as a nation. But then I received every briefing you can get in the Situation Room on what China's doing, Hugh, and it's made me an insomniac. I mean, they're on a pathway to beat us if we don't get our act together, and that's why I'm in this race. I'm the father of a two-year-old and a five-year-old, and my wife and I want their future to be the American future they deserve, and we're watching it slip away by the day, and that's why we're in this fight.
Now, Latham, you may not know this, but I got a son-in-law who's a naval aviator, a son who's a naval intelligence officer, and a nephew who's a Navy SEAL. And so I kind of said, I love Latham, sight unseen. So you got me. Which national security advisor did you serve under?
So I served under H.R. McMaster, and then I overlapped a little bit with John Bolton. It was an 18-month assignment, and I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, we put our adversaries on their heels every single day while we were up there. Candidly, Hugh, I mean, serving in the SEAL teams, I'm sure your nephew feels the same way. It was my dream job. If I had it my way, I'd still be running and gunning in the teams. I loved every minute of my 8 years on active duty, but transitioned out for pretty unique family reasons. I've got a twin brother with Down syndrome named Ashby, who's my hero. He's made me the man I am, and he lives with my parents, and they're not getting any younger, and there will be a day where he's going to come and live with us. And so I transitioned out to prepare for that. But I loved every minute
of it. I also understand that if you're not leading a team, you don't really want to be a SEAL forever. I know Admiral McRaven, for example, and I know he has trouble keeping young guys like you in the teams because they want to be out running and gunning. Rourke Dent. I just got so many SEAL buddies. And again, Navy family, nephew. Tell me a little bit about your vision for Georgia and this race. You're up against Herschel, and you're a dog, so you know what that means, right? That's like, okay, I'm a Navy SEAL. I'll run against Georgia's most famous individual. I can see you making that decision, but tell me how the race looks to you.
Yeah, well, thank you, Hugh. I mean, look, I tell folks all the time, I'm a Georgia Bulldog through and through. Herschel was my childhood football hero. However, I mean, these are incredibly serious times for our nation right now. Celebrities are not going to bail us out of this mess. We've got to do the work ourselves, and it's going to require serious leaders to do that and leaders that show up. And that, Hugh, the fascinating thing about running against Herschel Walker in this race is I always viewed him as a competitor. But, I mean, he is literally doing the Biden basement strategy. We just had our fifth and final debate two nights ago, and he was five times in a row a no-show. They had an empty podium for him, and that is not going to get the job done against Raphael Warnock. I mean, we saw him in action. You got to give him credit. He's a smooth candidate. He's a great debater. And we've got to have somebody that'll get up on the debate stage and hold Raphael Warnock accountable for the bag of goods that he sold Georgians. I call it the Warnock bag of goods, which is we have a terrorist run in Afghanistan. We have an open southern border, which is Warnock's dream, by the way. We have inflation that's running rampant. And my wife and I are still buying diapers for our youngest. The price of diapers is through the roof. And who does that hurt the most? Lower and middle income Americans, the same folks that Raphael Warnock claims his policies are best for. Well, I beg to differ, and I'm going to hold him accountable there. Now, Herschel Walker, he's in the lead right now, but what folks outside the state don't often realize is we have runoffs here in Georgia. If the number one candidate doesn't clear 50%, they go to a runoff with the number two guy. And with six of us in this race and Herschel polling in the high 50s, he's not going to clear 50%. I've out-fundraised all the other candidates besides Herschel combined. I've raised $4 million to date. We're deploying those resources. And then all of a sudden, Hugh, once I have Herschel in that runoff, the odds that are against me now flip in my favor overnight, because in Georgia, you do not want to be the number two candidate in a runoff, or you don't want to be the number one candidate in the runoff. You want to be number two. The number one position is cursed, and it's been that way all the way since Paul Coverdell. I mean, you lose.
I remember Paul Coverdell. One. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. You've got an ops plan. I'm not surprised. What is the website, Latham?
Yes, sir. So it's LathamSadler.com, LathamSadler. And please join the mission and support us. And if you're here in Georgia, you can vote now. We've got early voting from now all the way to Election Day on May 24th. So please support us. And I will fight for you every day in the United States Senate. I will fight for you and your children. And Hugh, it's an honor to be on your show.
Well, a couple more questions now, Latham. I've got your Twitter feed. I've retweeted your Twitter feed, and people will go to LathamSadler.com. On the domestic side, you're obviously a national security pro. I mean, there aren't many Farsi and Dari-speaking candidates running around the United States who've worked for General McMaster and John Bolton. And then you're a White House fellow. You left that off your resume, which is really sort of the icing on the cake. I believe you must have worked pretty closely with Jared at the time because you were working on the First Step Act. On the domestic side of the agenda, what would you go to the Senate and try and achieve?
Yeah, there's a couple things I want to do. Number one is we've got to secure the border. I mean, that is, it's so critical. We can no longer just talk about this issue, Hugh. I mean, now that we've got a terrorist war in Afghanistan and we have fentanyl coming over the border from China that's killing our youth more than anything, we've got to get serious about doing it. And the wall is part of the answer. I mean, I've received those briefings as well, where the Border Patrol agent shared that the wall helps funnel people into certain areas of the southern border. But there's also tunneling that goes underneath the wall. And we've got technologies right now that can secure our entire southern border, and we're not doing it, and there's no longer an excuse for it anymore. So that's my top priority up there. I also want to see us bring American manufacturing home from China. I mean, I would tell any any board member, any business executive, if you are investing in China right now, you're crazy. You better get out right now while you can. They are at a cold war with us, whether we want to be or not. We are with them. And they view us as a couple hundred year fad and view themselves as a 5,000 year dynasty and say the 20th century where you all reign supreme, that's an outlier on the graph. We're never letting that happen again. So we've got to start unwinding our manufacturing from China and bring it back home. But in order to do that, we've got to have the workers. I mean, every conservative candidate in the country talks about how we have to bring the manufacturing back home and build factories. Well, who's going to build the stuff in the factories? So I want to see us invest far more in two-year degrees in vocational tech. We've got to get away from the only way that you have a pathway to success and dignity in this nation is a four-year degree. We've got to start investing in those two-year degrees. And I can help do that from the United States Senate. Then we have the talent here. And we can bring the factories home and start building again in America. And I want to see that happen, obviously, here in Georgia.
Okay, Latham, we have time for this. Given your experience with your brother, who has Down syndrome, I have never known the parent or the sibling of an intellectually challenged individual not to be extremely pro-life. But given the debate this week about Dobbs, I'd like to hear your position on that opinion and on the general issue.
Well, thank you, Hugh, and you're right. I mean, my brother is the main reason that I have the view I do. I am very proudly pro-life. I mean, it's unconscionable to me that you have countries like Iceland that are trying to get rid of people like my brother totally through abortion. So look, when I read this draft, I was happy to see that, very happy to see that. I mean, I was very disappointed in the leak. I think more people should be talking about that. And I hope our justices remain safe and strong. But we should be proud to be pro-life. This is an issue, Hugh, that, I mean, the future is going to judge those on this issue. And I think as Republicans, sometimes folks are a little bit shy about being pro-life. I'm as somebody who shared the womb with somebody that has Down syndrome, I couldn't be more proud to defend life.
All right. My very last question, Latham, has to do with the Iranian regime, which you know so well. It appears that they're trying to kill people in the United States. There was the story about your old boss, John Bolton, being targeted and having had 24/7 security. It's a two-part question. One, should we be protecting everybody that we know is on their list 24/7 around the clock? Because the Biden administration keeps playing around with that decision, as I'm sure you know. And number two, what ought we to send as a message of what will happen if they actually endanger an American via the Quds Force?
Yeah, so great questions. On the first one, Hugh, I mean, we ought to have a strong enough domestic security that we don't have to have around-the-clock protection for folks that are on that list, because anybody and everybody could be on that list. Candidly, I should be on that list. So I don't think we need 24-hour around-the-clock security for those on that list. We should have strong enough security nationwide in this country that Iranians can't go running around targeting people. So that's one. Number two, if they ever did, I think we need to make it abundantly clear that it doesn't get more extreme in that and targeting the United States, and that would be an act of war. I think Iran has run rampant throughout the Middle East. They've made it abundantly clear it's their goal to dominate the Middle East. They view weakness in our current administration as an opportunity to execute on their agenda. And I share all the time, Hugh, I shared it with the Ukraine issue as well, that wokeness equals weakness equals wars we do not want. And that's why we are where we are with Ukraine. I mean, under Reagan, as you know, it was all about peace through strength. And our enemies feared us, and that's why we prevailed against the Soviet Union. We've got to have leaders that our adversaries are going to take seriously. And when our president of the United States can't even get a return call from the UAE, I mean, that shows you really where we are right now. And it's why we've got to win these midterms in November that are critical to stop the bleeding out of Washington. It's why we got to win in 2024. We've got to win the White House back.
Latham Sadler, great to meet you via Skype and on the air. Come back. Good luck getting to the runoff with Herschel. I think you're right about not getting to 50%. I hope you're number two. And everyone, LathamSadler.com. Thank you, Latham. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt with my regular guest, former Senator Jim Talent from Missouri, now at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Senator, did you hear Latham Sadler just now?
No, I did not. I was busy preparing for the incisive questions you're going to ask. So okay, I usually turn the show off for a couple minutes before I actually do my hit.
I'm going to replay it at 8:33. My question to you is, he's one of the most impressive debut interviews I've ever heard. 8 years in the SEALs, National Security Council under both McMaster and Bolton, White House fellow then, worked on First Step, has a twin brother in the womb with him who has Down syndrome. He's very pro-life. He speaks Farsi and Dari. He knows all about the Iranian threat. He knows all about the border issues. I'm just blown away by how prepared he is. I've never heard of him until Sunday. What is wrong? I know all about Herschel Walker. I know Herschel's probably going to be the nominee down there. But what is wrong with our media when we don't actually know things like this? How come I don't know this?
Yeah, if you don't know it, then there does seem to have been a shortfall in the media presence in Georgia. But look, if he doesn't win, and I agree, I think Walker's going to win, and I think he's a fine candidate. I talk a lot with young people wanting to get into politics, and you know, you have other opportunities. In other words, you run a good campaign, you create a base of support. That base of support is still there for other opportunities in the future. And I'm sure if he doesn't win, that we'll hear more about him in the future, because I'm sure he's impressing people in Georgia.
Oh, well, he's raised $4 million in a campaign against Herschel Walker, and he'll make the runoff if there is a runoff. So he will. But I just don't think he can beat Herschel Walker in Georgia. Jim Talent, let me ask you about J.D. Vance in Ohio. Now, obviously, President Trump moved that race. But my takeaway, and I want to know what yours is that there's a 10-point bump in a Trump endorsement, and there's a 10-point bump for the person who's not the Trump guy, in this case, State Senator Matt Dolan. Both of those guys went up 10 points after Trump endorsed the former and blasted the latter. What do you think about my take?
Yeah, I think it's probably valid in that context. I think it depends very much on the state and the race that you're talking about. I have a view of voters that is different than many people in politics. I think they act rationally in terms of how they define their interests. So I think they take endorsements into account. Whether an endorsement is decisive for a particular voter depends on what he or she thinks about the candidates on other issues. It depends on how powerfully attached they are to the endorser. So I think it varies a lot. And I say this to people who seek endorsements from me. One of the things I warn them about is that sometimes with an endorsement, okay, you get the baggage of the endorser, but you don't get the virtues. You see what I'm saying? In other words,
yes.
People who don't like the endorser don't like you because you've been endorsed by that person. But the people who do like the endorser, it's not a powerful enough attachment to move their vote in your direction. So it's you have to be careful with it, okay? But I think the president has such a loyal following, and in a race like that, which was so up in the air anyway, I think it had a big impact.
Now, as a pro-lifer, I have to ask you, because I know you're a pro-lifer as well, what did you make of the leak, and what do you make of the draft opinion? How do you hope this all turns out?
Well, a draft opinion showed what you know better than anybody because you're a constitutional lawyer, which is there is no coherent theory of constitutional jurisprudence which justifies Roe versus Wade, right? Now, in terms of the court, I think it's a real plus that Breyer is going to be on there for a while because I think Breyer cares about the institutional integrity of the court, and he'll help the chief come up with a response, a consensus response that's appropriate on the court. Politically, I think this is at least a short-term benefit for the Democrats because it gives them something to talk about you other than the issues which are killing them, which are all the other issues. Inflation, crime, the border. The problem is that abortion is not a push issue. It's not an issue that moves a big segment of the voters. And those for whom it is a push issue have already decided. And that's a basic political logic that I don't.
Jim, do you think it's a problem that they don't have a stopping, they don't have a middle ground, that it's really abortion on demand right up through birth? And go ahead.
Because the danger for the Democrats here is that they will substantively or rhetorically gild the lily too much. And so they'll turn abortion into an issue that is hurting them. Although, again, this is because voters vote based on how they define their interests, not on how the Beltway defines their interests. I don't expect the underlying logic of abortion as a political issue to change, but it could if really either side reacts in a way that shows an intolerance towards people who disagree differently, who disagree with them on the issue. Let me put it that way.
Boy, that's well put, because Joni Ernst yesterday, Nikki Haley yesterday, John Thune in the Senate, Mitch McConnell in the Senate, they're all so eloquent and moderate in their responses. And the Democrats have gone over another cliff. It's as though they can never not go too far.
It's one of their issues that
they just overestimate. They just always overestimate the enthusiasm that they can generate outside of their base, their 10%. Jim Talent can be found on Twitter at Jim Talent. I can be found right here in hour number two. Scott Pruitt, Oklahoma candidate in Senate, right down there, is next. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. Morning glory. I'm Hugh Hewitt, inside the Beltway, live on 5-5-2022. Not only are there crowded fields in Pennsylvania and Georgia Senate races, there's one in Oklahoma where my friend Scott Pruitt, former administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency and member of Donald Trump's cabinet, as well as the former Attorney General of Oklahoma, is running. Good morning, Scott Pruitt. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Welcome home, Hugh.
Back in the Beltway. Glad to be back in the country. Administrator Pruitt, I used to call you General Pruitt. I still do, because when I first met you, you were the Attorney General of Oklahoma. All of a sudden, that ought to be a credential that matters in Oklahoma, because abortion rights is on everyone's mind. And I have to imagine you had to deal with these issues when you were being the chief law enforcement officer of the Sooner State.
Yes, Hugh, and let me first say the sanctity of that process. It is so dispiriting to see what has transpired with the release of the draft. As you know, each of the justices has four clerks, and there's a support staff at the court. And this is just, again, very dispiriting to see something like this occur where there's a release of a draft and the confidentiality breached. And so it's very disappointing, having lived that, you know, very intimately with cases that we have before the Supreme Court. It's just shocking to see. But when you think about this decision that's forthcoming, much can change between now and the time of the order being released. But I will tell you, Roe is wrong fundamentally, Hugh, because it got the first question wrong, which is the unborn child a person? And in fact, Justice Blackmun asked that question in the Roe versus Wade opinion. And he said, if the unborn child is a person, our analysis must stop. Now, why is that, Hugh? Because the 14th Amendment says no person can be deprived of life without due process of law. And so the very fundamental question, the underpinnings of the Roe opinion, in my estimation, were wrongly decided at the outset. Common law leading up to Roe protected unborn life from the moment that life was first evident. It was called quickening. And Roe changed that. It created a culture of a death as opposed to a culture of life. And so I'm very hopeful and optimistic that the court will ultimately decide that Roe was wrongly decided and give protections to the unborn child across the country, which means the states need to step up and do that once the opinion is released.
Now, you are correct. And in fact, most states still have in their common law or in their statutes that if you murder a woman carrying a child, you've got two murder counts against you. Was that the case in Oklahoma when you were the attorney general?
Yeah, there are statutes actually that predated Roe and actually that were post-date Roe that said similar things, Hugh. But I will tell you, it's really more fundamental. I mean, those criminal statutes obviously dominated the marketplace, the legal marketplace prior to Roe. But there are going to be new issues post this decision. And fundamentally, you're going to see attacks at the state level where the abortion rights that were enshrined in the Constitution by judicial activism in 1973, you'll see proponents of abortion take the same approach with state constitutions across the country. Well, they will argue that there's a state constitutional right to an abortion. And so states, governors, legislators all over the country need to be prepared for taking steps now to protect the unborn child against those kinds of encroachments.
Now, I am a big believer in states' attorney general becoming senators. I think Josh Hawley has done a great job. Ted Cruz was the solicitor general of Texas. It matters a lot. Do people still remember your service in the Sooner State as the state attorney general, or do they just remember you as the U.S. Administrator of EPA?
Look, I mean, as you know, Hugh, when I was attorney general, I sued the Obama administration on the Clean Power Plan. I sued the Obama administration on the Waters of the United States rule because they were what? Not consistent with the statute that had been passed by Congress. And we won on those cases. We got stays, you know, issued by the Supreme Court in those cases. And on the other end, as an EPA administrator, I repealed them. So I bookended the, you know, the ultra liberal approach of the Obama administration with very key pieces of rulemaking from the Clean Power Plan to WOTUS. And I think Oklahomans remember that very, very fond. Look, I mean, the EPA was weaponized against producers in this country, not just the energy sector, but against the ag sector, against manufacturing. And what we saw under the Obama administration that we fixed in the Trump administration was this overzealous anti-producer mentality that used the EPA as a weapon as opposed to what? A good steward of the natural resources that we've been blessed with.
Scott Pruitt, on Tuesday night, the Nixon seminar met in virtually in California, and they had as their guests Mike Pompeo and Robert O'Brien, your old colleagues, Rick Perry and Dan Brulé.
Yeah.
And they talked about energy as a national security issue, and I applauded that. You want to comment on that?
Yes, look, I mean, energy independence, Hugh, is not just about gas prices here at home. It truly is about our influence abroad. American energy can be a powerful foreign policy tool, as you know, a tool we can use to curb, you know, the creeping influence of Russia and China. If we are to advance economic interests here at home, we need to what? Ensure that we have energy independence. But if, you know, energy independence means a safer and freer world abroad. And so it is a tool just like currency. And so we must make a decision here domestically to develop our natural resources in a way that blesses our people, but also makes the world freer.
So update us on the Oklahoma race, Administrator Pruitt or General Pruitt or whatever we just call you, Scott Pruitt. What's your website? Scott Pruitt, okay, on Twitter, but what's the website?
ScottPruittForOklahoma.com.
Okay. So how's it going?
ScottForOklahoma.com is the landing page for folks who want to get involved in the movement. Look, I mean, my race fundamentally, Hugh, is about keeping keeping the dream alive. And I'm not just talking about the American dream of, you know, prosperity and economic prosperity. I'm talking about the fundamental concepts of what our founders fought for. Liberty and freedom, that there's a role for the federal government, there's a role for the state governments, but ultimately both the role of the federal and state governments is to what? Promote freedom among the people, to pursue opportunity. And I'm really concerned that with the overreach of the federal government, the encroachment of the federal government, and free speech as an example, free speech is under attack. You know, big tech is leading the charge with help from the government. And, you know that, how it works. So you have government that cannot ban speech, but they authorize private big tech to do so, and they give them the immunity to do so. And so free speech is under attack. I mean, fundamental freedoms are under attack. And so we need to make sure that we take appropriate steps to restore those principles that we had at the outset of our country, and they're under attack. So we need to make sure that we advance them.
This is a nuts and bolts radio audience. They like to know the sort of internal mechanics of campaign. How's Scott Pruitt advancing the campaign on the ground? You got two major markets there, Oklahoma City and Tulsa. I really don't know how one runs in a state that big with two big markets. Tell us.
Well, it's a quick race, Hugh. I mean, June 28th is the election date. And so this is not your typical going from Woodward to Poteau to Tulsa to Oklahoma City and all points in between. I mean, this is a race where digital platforms, getting the message out through social media and otherwise on messaging, obviously raising money to help do the ads on television as well. But fundamentally, my objective is to remind people that I am a fighter and that I've exhibited courage, and that we've taken on these issues and made tremendous change in a very short time frame. I mean, I was a Republican conservative leading the most liberal agency in the U.S. government. And with that agency, Hugh, as you know, we went from energy dependence and all the bad decisions of the Obama administration to righted them in 18 months, saving billions of dollars to the American economy, getting out of the Paris Accord, and truly achieving energy independence that blessed the world. I mean, we can do those things if we have decisive leadership. And I was that kind of leader at the EPA. I was that kind of leader as the attorney general. And I'll be that kind of leader as a U.S. Senator. Scott, and that's reminding people.
Give people a little bit of your bio before that, just in case someone is listening in Oklahoma City or Tulsa that wasn't voting when you ran twice statewide successfully.
You know, before that, I was a baseball guy. You know, owned a baseball team and owned the AAA baseball team in Oklahoma City. We were a Texas Rangers affiliate. And so that was a wonderful time. We were in the Pacific Coast League with Branch Rickey's grandson as the head of the Pacific Coast League. And so we had good relationships and still have good relationships in baseball across the country, and was an entrepreneur at that time. And since that time, since I left the administration in 2018, I've been involved in lithium development and carbon offsets and credits and various LNG exports to areas of the world that are impacted by what's going on in Ukraine and Sofia, Bulgaria and Bucharest, Romania and the Czech Republic and other places. So, you know, I've been focused firsthand from a business perspective since I left the administration on making sure that American energy was in areas of the world that could benefit from that. So a number of things, both since 2018, but also before my time as Attorney General.
We got less than a minute, Scott Pruitt. If you get into the Senate, will you ask to be on the committee that oversees EPA? Because you know what the left is doing there since they got it back.
Yeah, look, I think absolutely. And I'll also say this, Hugh. I mean, the regulatory processes that have been abused at the EPA are not unique to that agency. It is really across the federal government. And so there needs to be an accountability, if you will, from Congress, the legislative branch, toward the executive branch. There's too much delegation of authority. The U.S. Senate needs to legislate. Congress needs to legislate, not the executive branch.
Scott for Oklahoma.com to be part of the cause. Scott Pruitt for Oklahoma to learn the bio if you don't already know it. Follow him on Twitter at Scott Pruitt. Okay. Follow me to the next segment. Thank you, Scott Pruitt. I'll be right back, America, on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt live on this 5/5/22. Years and years ago, I came off the D.C. circuit, went to the Department of Justice, and had the great honor and privilege of working for two attorney generals, one William French Smith and then Ed Meese, both of them Californians. And now the later, General Meese, is being honored by Pepperdine University. The dean of the School of Public Policy, Pete Peterson, joins me now. Good morning early to you, Pete, up in California. I appreciate your joining me because I just want to toast you for honoring Ed Meese, who really is just the definition of public service.
Well, we couldn't agree more, Hugh, and good morning from Malibu. We're so excited about this week's announcement regarding the new Meese Institute for Liberty and the American Project here at the Graduate Policy School.
Tell us about that institute. How did it come to be named for General Meese? And is he going to be able to join you for the opening?
Yeah, so the background's really super interesting. A couple who have been affiliated with Pepperdine, actually both Pepperdine alums, had been working internationally for about 10 years, returned to the United States, and went through that process that we're hearing more and more of sending their kids into school that was teaching them some rather woke and ideological things, and realized how much their country had changed while they had been out of the country. With that, they had reached out to Pepperdine and wanted to discuss a large gift that would create an institute that would defend America's founding principles. And that series of conversations began about a year and a half ago and came to a point where they have made a $10 million commitment to create the institute. Now, after they had made that initial commitment, within a few months, they said, you know, our name doesn't have to be on the institute itself. If it
would
help create awareness to what you're doing there at Pepperdine and the Graduate Policy School, let's think about another name. And so that began the series of discussions and deliberations to find a name of someone who stood for America's founding principles and their relevance to today's policy issues. And over the course of a few months, we explored several different options, considered a few different options. But General Meese has had an affiliation with Pepperdine going back decades. We've given him an honorary degree here at the policy school, and through various relationships, particularly Ed Fulner's, who's on our board here at the policy school, that began the concerted discussions with General Meese to discuss with him the possibility of naming this institute for him.
Well, you know, I've known the general for so long. I tell you how long. I was a young special assistant. We used to sit around in the Friday all-hands staff meeting with the special assistants against the wall and the serious people, players at the table. And after the birth of my first child, my daughter, the general stopped the meeting and had me stand up and got applause for me because I, you know, new parents need that. And now that daughter is about to have her fourth child. So that's how long I've known Ed Meese. And he's never changed. He's really one of the most wonderful, as is Ursula, as is their entire family. Really one of the most wonderful people, but a committed. I mean, he got Ronald Reagan elected. He served him in the White House. He served him as AG. You could not have a better person to name the Institute for, Pete Peterson.
No, we couldn't. Again, we're so honored by his agreement with it. And I have to say, the meeting to discuss this and to confirm his support for it happened in the home of Ed and Ursula about a month and a half ago. And in that conversation, which included the husband of the donor couple, as well as Ed Fulner, I have to say it was an out-of-body experience for me to be sitting across from Ed and Ursula to talk about this opportunity at the policy school and to gain his their agreement and support for this new initiative. I often say I'm the most grateful dean in America, and now to launch this new institute named for such a great American patriot that aligns so closely with his interests and career. Again, just very grateful.
And Pepperdine is a great Christian university, as are Ed and Ursula Meese. But I'll bet you the general hesitated because he is such a humble man. I mean, he's a committed intellectual and fighter and smart guy. But he's so humble, Pete Peterson.
Yeah, that's true. And again, in the conversations that we've had with him over the course of the last 3 or 4 months, it is fair to say that he was taken aback by the proposal that we made to him around naming this for him. It certainly was not something he was seeking. We came to him hat in hand and just hoped that he would agree and be excited about what this academic institute is going to be about and how closely, again, it aligns with his life commitment toward the Constitution and applying America's founding principles.
And California. He's a great Golden Stater.
Yeah, and again, just so funny, he actually was a classmate of my mother-in-law up in Oakland in elementary school. So, you know, so many connections there.
Ed Meese and Ursula Meese, congratulations to you and to you, Pete Peterson, and to Pepperdine University's Graduate School of Public Policy, the school at Pepperdine of Public Policy. If you're interested at all, there's no more beautiful place in the world, and there's no more serious place in the world. And now it's a place of great honor to a great man of American law. Ed Meese. I'll be back tomorrow, America, on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.